Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the confusion. Happy I was able to come. I got a frantic text message on, it must have been Friday at 2 o'clock in the morning, you have to change your plans, I can't make it, my flight was messed up, so I ended up changing a flight from Toronto just to come, so happy I got here. And quickly pulled together something I've been thinking about for a while. Really, I owe Rabbi J.J. Schachter really a debt of gratitude for pointing me to this Tosefta, which is on the front of this of the Makorot sheet, just as an incredible text to start to learn through as we think about qualities of leadership for our children and for adults as well. So why don't we jump into this Tosefta, and then we'll take a step back and think about some of the points in it as well. So this Tosefta is in Brachos, Perek Dalid, and it's Tet Zayin, and I put some numbers on the side just for convenience when we'll reference it. But basically the context is a conversation between Rabbi Tarfon and his students. Rabbi Tarfon and his students are sitting and they're discussing just different things that come up. And what comes up here, I want to ask you a question. He says, Lamdinu, I'm at the beginning of Tet Zayin. Teach us something. Amar Lahem, Mekne Ma Zacha Yehuda L'malchus. Why did Yehuda, Zocha, why did he merit the Malchus, that his offspring would become, the Davidic lineage would have exclusive rights to the king, to be kings? And he says, and that's what Rabbi Tarfon asks, is Amru Lo, and the students respond, Mibnei Shehoda B'Tamar, because he admitted the sin of Tamar. Right, everybody, just to refresh our memories, right, Yehuda he gave his two children to Tamar, and they sinned, they were killed. He neglected to give his third son, Shelah, to Tamar. Yehuda, Tamar then dresses up, she as a harlot. Yehuda takes her. Yehuda, you know, leaves a signet and a staff and a cloak with her, you know, and never is able to find her again. When it turns out she's pregnant, and Yehuda takes her out to burn her because she has violated, you know, the status of Yibum. Tamar presents the signet and the staff. Yehuda admits his mistake and says Sad Kabimeni, that she was the one who was correct. And right, from that there were twins that were born, Peretz and Zarah, and from that was really the Davidic lineage, from that union of Yehuda with his daughter-in-law. So the Tosefta here says, the students of Rabbi Tarfon says, why is Rabbi Yehuda Zocha to be a leader? Why is the Davidic lineage come from Yehuda? It comes because he admitted his sin with Tamar. So why do you think, just take a step back, it's not a huge group, so we can do a little audience participation. Why do you think that this would be a quality of leadership? Hoda b'Tamar. Any suggestions from the crowd? Admitting mistakes, humility. So we'll see both of those ideas in a minute. So admitting mistakes. So I think admitting mistakes, I think, is an interesting way of putting this, right? Admitting mistakes. And if you look, and there, just by the way, on page 2 here is a translation of Tosefta, if anybody wants to consult with that. It's from the newsroom volume. But if you turn to page 3, see just a quote here from the Medrash Sifron Vayikra, just to go on admitting mistakes, acknowledging error. There's a famous Sifron Vayikra where Vayikra lists all the karbanos, and the karbanos go, key, if this happens, if this happens, if this happens, if this happens, and with one exception, it says, asher nasiachata, when a king, when a leader sins. And Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Medrash says, Ashrei, a play on the word Asher, Ashrei Hador Shahanasi Shelo Mevi Chatas Al Shigato. Blessed be the generation where a leader, where a Nasi, brings a Chatat on his mistakes. And for sure, right, that he'll admit his mistakes on willful errors, if he's already bringing a chatas on something he did b'shogeg. So we have this idea that leaders are just ingrained within leadership is making mistakes, and a great generation are those leaders, right? Asher, a nasi is for sure going to make a mistake. A leader is going to make mistakes. A great leader, a real true leader, is one who admits mistakes. If you look up Isaiah Berlin, a famous 20th century British philosopher, wrote an essay called Political Judgment, or On Political Judgment. And he says there that in the realm of political action, there are few laws, and what is needed instead is skill in reading a situation. Successful statesmen do not think in general terms. Instead, they grasp the unique combination of characteristics that constitute this particular situation, this and no other. The idea that we're too often, we have rules and we follow those rules in every situation. And real political judgment, according to Berlin, is the idea that each situation presents its own unique concerns, its own unique challenges, its own salient features. And if we're too quick to apply rules and laws and generalities to those specific situations, then leaders will make mistakes. That a true leader, good political judgment, is the ability to figure out what that situation calls for. Right? Is that situation call for deep rebuke that we just had in Parshas Chukas? Right? Moshe was facing the nation who were clamoring for water. And he reacts differently. Right here, as opposed to in Bishalach, right here he says, Shimuna Hamorim, he rebukes them very, very stringently, right? Very, very harshly. Shimuna Hamorim minasel azenu timayim. Right? He says, listen, you rebellious ones, will I bring water from this rock? And according to some Rishonim, that itself was a sin. That in that moment, that's not what it called for. It was a lack of a certain judgment of Moshe. Then every situation requires a different type of judgment. We don't necessarily apply the same rule, the same exact, in a different generation, the same way Moshe acted in Shemot, maybe is not the way he should react in Bamidbar. And I think that's the point that Berlin is making here. And the idea, and this is something that Michael Walzer, the political philosopher from Columbia, talks about, is that there's a problem of dirty hands. The famous essay he wrote, The Problem of Dirty Hands, that there's, in politics, often we get our hands dirty, and that's sometimes the morally correct thing to do. But we make mistakes in that regard. We don't necessarily know if it's the correct answer or not the correct answer until years later. And the idea that a nasi is willing to make mistakes as one to admit those mistakes as a quality of leadership. So let's turn back to the Tosefta. So just aspect of leadership number one that comes out of this Tosefta from the students of Rabbi Tarfon is the ability to admit mistakes and how to react to a mistake. But if we skip down a little bit, Rabbeinu Tarfon answers, and this is, if you look just the line before number two, Amar Lahem, Rabbi Tarfon answers, and he says, V'chinotnin skar al ha'avera, will we give schar to Yehuda, he will zochet to the malchus, he will merit to become a king because he did a sin, because he sinned with Tamar, that's why we're going to give him this kingship. Does that make sense? So he rejects, or Tarfon rejects his student's answer. He rejects his student saying, Mitnei Shehoda L'Tamar. He says, give me a different answer. Mitnei Ma Zacha Yehuda L'Malchus. Why did Yehuda get Malchus? So the students come back and they give another answer. And they say, Mitnei Shehitzil Et Echav Min Hamisa. We all know the famous story, right? Shenemar Bayomer Yehuda El Echav Ma Betza Chinarog. Right, we all know the famous story, right? The Yosef is in the pit. The brothers want to kill him. He's screaming. Yehuda says, rather than kill him, let's sell him to the Ishmaelim. Right, this act, he saved his brothers. And this, I believe, the concept that they're saying here is all the brothers were going one way, right? The peer pressure in that regard was to kill his brother. But that was the peer pressure. But what Yehuda did is he stood up and he said, this is not the way to do it. We have another option. We can save our brother from death. We can instead sell him. Now, maybe you should have saved him completely and not sold him. Maybe that's part of the political judgment we spoke about in the first section, right? That sometimes you have to make a decision of what's going to be, what's going to work and what's not going to work. Maybe saving him would never have flown with the brothers, and selling him would have. But that act where he went against what his brothers were trying to convince him to do, this idea of going against the grain. And that if you look again at page 3, I brought the famous poem from Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverge in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Right? The idea that everybody's going one way, sometimes what a leader has to do is go the other way. And so look, I just brought another quote from Rabbi Sacks as well, who, if you've had a chance to look at his Covenant and Conversation this year, it's all been about leadership, and it's been incredible just the way he's tied leadership to the parsha. I recommend everything he's doing is incredible. And what he did, I think this is, might have been in one of them or in a different place, he said that Abraham is without a doubt the most influential person who ever lived. Today he is claimed as a spiritual ancestor of 2.4 billion Christians, 1.6 billion Muslims, and 13 million Jews, more than half the people alive today. Yet he ruled no empire, commanded no great army, performed no miracles, and proclaimed no prophecy. He's the supreme example in all of history of influence without power. Why, Rabbi Sacks asks? Because he was prepared to be different. As the sages say, he was called Ha'ivri, the Hebrew, because all the world was on one side and he was on the other. Leadership, as every leader knows, can be lonely. Yet you continue to do what you have to do because you know that the majority is not always right and conventional wisdom is not always wise. Dead fish go with the flow, live fish swim against the current. So it is with conscience and courage. So it is with the children of Abraham. They are prepared to challenge the idols of the age. And Warren Bennis, one of the great leadership gurus, he's written a number of books on geeks and geezers and different books on leadership. I'm from Harvard Business School. He wrote that by the time we reach puberty, the world has shaped us to a greater extent than we realize. Our family, friends, and society in general have told us by word and example how to be. But people begin to become leaders at that moment when they decide for themselves how to be. So that idea where of going against the grain, of standing up when everyone is going a different direction and you have to stand up to that tide, the idea of going against the grain as a leader. As we know, the studies on this, on peer pressure in general, are incredible. I was the rabbi at the University of Pennsylvania, and I always say that, you know, one of my, just since we're talking here about the year in Israel and sort of the educational challenges, one of my deep frustrations was in the preparations for that year in Israel, was that what preparing them in yeshiva to go into Penn, we were preparing them to learn all day when you have all day and all night to learn. That's the only preparation we're giving to a campus life where no one around you is learning and you don't have all day and all night to learn. So how do those two experiences, how does that transition work to each other? How are we preparing our youth and our students to become leaders on campus and to go against the grain if all the educational experiences we've given them up until that point are to do what you're doing because your friends are doing it? So to think very carefully about how peer pressure plays, what role that plays in our educational messaging. There are famous studies, right? They took two lines where one is obviously longer than the other. There's a study out of Stanford University. And everybody in the room, they prepare them beforehand that when we ask you which line is longer, you're going to give the wrong answer. And they have a few people in the room who don't know this. And they, to a statistical, like an incredible statistical number, will answer that the shorter line is longer because everybody else in the room is saying that the shorter line is longer. And the idea that you're prepared to say something you know is not true just because of the peers around you. It's this idea that what we need to train as something in leadership is the value of going against the grain, of standing against the tide of iconoclasm. So that's the second idea of the aspects of leadership. The problem is that Rabbi Tarfon doesn't like this either. Rabbi Tarfon, if we look, he says, Amar lei, daya lahatzela shetachaper al hamachira. Meaning, they saved him, but you need that because you sold him. You sold him, you saved him. That has to cancel each other out. You can't use this to give him another, an additional merit that Yehuda is going to get malchus because he saved him and sold him. So he asks another question. So he asks it again. Throws it out again to his students. And a third student raises his hand and says, "Mipnei ha'anava," which we heard before, because of humility. Where is the humility? Shnemar v'ata yashivna abdecha v'gomer. That when Yehuda was standing in front of Yosef, and Binyamin was about to be taken as a servant, as a slave to Yosef, that Yehuda volunteered himself instead. And what's interesting about this, and I think this I turn again to Rabbi Sachs, is what is humility in the Torah? And you know, we can, if we had more time, we could discuss it. But I think humility in the Torah is not the way it's normally seen, as self-effacement or low estimate of oneself. We turn to page 4. And this is again a quote from Rabbi Sachs. He says, humility is not what is sometimes taken to be a low estimate of oneself. This is false or counterfeit humility. True humility is mindlessness of self. Right? The idea that humility is not thinking yourself as less, but putting a mission or a cause in front of oneself. The ability to sacrifice oneself to that cause. That's what leadership is. Putting ideas, putting ideals above the self and sacrificing to the cause. So Yehuda here, in sacrificing himself for this cause, right, sacrificing himself, saying the cause, the brothers, the family, is more important than my own personal gain. I will become a slave rather than have Binyamin and, you know, and Yaakov will fall apart because of this, rather than the family fall apart. So, and you can read the rest of the Rabbi Sachs quote just if you'd like, but that idea of humility as sacrificing oneself to the cause. We have a few minutes, right, to read a little bit, right? So we can read, what time? 10 minutes. So we can read for one. Why don't we read one more minute, just because I think it's an incredible piece here. So he says, if we look at the second paragraph here, humility is not self-abasement. It is not self-anything. It is the ability to stand in silent awe in the presence of otherness, the thou of God, the otherness of other people, the majesty of creation, the beauty of the world, the power of great ideas, the call of great ideals. Humility is the silence of the self in the presence of that which is greater than the self. A leader, indeed anyone who follows in the footsteps of the prophets, is caught in the impossible tension between the demands of and the wishes of the people. The Torah has left us with an indelible image. Yaakov wrestling with the angel only to be told that his name will henceforth be Israel, one who wrestles with God and with human beings and prevails. No wonder that four leaders in the Bible, Moses, Elijah, Jonah, and Jeremiah, pray to die rather than to carry on. No wonder either that those who most challenge their contemporaries, Lincoln, Gandhi, Kennedy, King, Sadat, and Rabin, were assassinated. How do leaders survive? Some by cunning and adroitness, some by ruthless suppression of opponents, others by indomitable belief in themselves. None of these apply to true spiritual giants, nor are they worthy of emulation by us. True leaders survive by believing in the cause, not in themselves. They do not take personal attacks personally. They respect the fact that their message will be difficult, and they are asking others to change, and that change is never less than painful. Like that idea of training in our children the ability to think of the cause in front of themselves and seeding that. And that's what I think some of our high schools are doing so well now in extracurricular and co-curricular activities. Some of the, right, putting, when you have a cause and everybody has to sacrifice for that cause, even a sports team, those types of sacrifices train this type of humility of putting something in front of themselves, of suppressing the own personal ego and the own personal gains, right? So much about our educational system, about personal gains. What college can you get into? But if we can suppress some of that and think about, okay, can you be part of something bigger? could be Israel advocacy. It could be a youth movement like NCSY or Bnei Akiva. It could be, again, a sports team, but something like that where you sacrifice your own personal gains for something larger trains this characteristic of humility, which I think is another core aspect of leadership. So, Rabbi Tarfon, if we go back to the first page, doesn't like this either. And there's actually some other sources. If we look at two lines above the number four, he says, Amar Lahem, V'lo arevu v'sofu shel arev, let's say kidei arvuto. He says, Yehuda here wasn't doing anything so special. Yehuda guaranteed Binyamin's life. He was an arev, he was a guarantor. And arev, a guarantor, has to fulfill his obligation. By putting himself in front of Binyamin, he wasn't doing anything special. That can't be a reason why he's zochel amalchut. There must be another reason. So finally the students say, the students finally give up and they say, fine, you tell us, Rabbi Tarfon. Why was he Zocha? Why did he merit Malchus? Here's a very fascinating answer. Amar lehem, Rabbi Tarfon says, because he sanctified God's name. Shvatim v'amdu al hayam, when the tribe stood on the seashore, on the reed sea, zel mer aniorev, kafat shivtol shel Yehuda, v'yared b'tchila, v'kidei shemo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we all know the story. Everybody was debating, do I go down into the sea? And who went in first? Nachshon ben Aminadav here in the Tosefta, interestingly, it's the entire Shevet Yehuda. It's not specifically Nachshon ben Aminadav. The entire Shevet Yehuda goes into the Yam first. They initiate the splitting of the sea. They're Mekadesh Hashem, Hashem, and this moment. But what's the problem with this answer? Huh? Right. The question is, why did Yehuda merit Malchus? And we're talking about something that happens generations later, 400 years later, when, or 210 years later, whatever it is, when Bnei Israel go into the Yamsuf, that's when this act happened. Yehuda was Zocha L'Malchus much earlier. So something I heard from Rabbi Schachter in explaining this is based on this line. And I thought of, when I heard him speak about it, I heard this line by Rabbi Sachs, who was talking about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that a good leader creates followers, but a great leader creates leaders. Then what? Why did Yehuda Zocha L'Malchus? We didn't know at that moment. Yehuda at that moment, we didn't know if he was going to Zocha L'Malchus. But when an opportunity came 200 years later, to Mekadei Shem Shamayim, which Shevet jumped into the water? Who created an environment and transmitted the ideals and the values that when the opportunity came, they were going to take the initiative and jump into the water? Yehuda did that. And that's what great leadership is. Great leadership is not necessarily the one who is standing up in the rah-rah in the middle of the circle. Great leadership is somebody who's perhaps with a whisper in the ear, perhaps by creating an environment, is somebody who creates an opportunity for leaders to emerge, for those to come to the next step and to say, when there is an opportunity, Mekadesh Hashem, this is what I'm, they're going to do that. That's what a great leader is. So just to sum up, and I think, look, you know, that's, as we think about our educational institutions, that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to create great leaders. And to create great leaders, what we need to do is create that environment through which leaders can emerge, and sometimes we won't know that until later, right? That's why, you know, institutions, you know, they have to build their alumni and they have to tout their alumni, because it's only after a generation where we see, look, this is who I can point to. This is a great leader who came out. And I know that that environment that we created, I don't know what exactly it was, but the environment that we created was one that fostered great leadership. And we could obviously do that in our homes as well, right? In our families, right? That we foster that by Yehuda and his families. He created an environment in his own family that his children and his children's children as children's children, who were sitting with him in the Mitzrayim, they saw somebody who was a leader, and they were able to take that initiative to become a leader later. So we saw, just to sum up, we saw these four aspects of leadership that I think come out of this Tosefta beautifully. As we think about in our educational goals for our children, there really are four goals we should keep in mind. Number one, right, this idea of admitting error. This idea of not always thinking you're right, and training the idea that admitting error is not failure, but it's a sign of leadership. Number two, the ability to train this ability to go against the grain, to not always follow what everybody's doing, the dangers of peer pressure, and to train a degree of iconoclasm and independence early on because of the dangers of peer pressure. Number three, the idea of humility, and humility, as we discussed, not necessarily self-abasement, but sacrificing oneself to a cause and thinking educationally how we can create causes and create those opportunities for our children. And number four, Rabbi Tarfon's final answer, can we create that environment where we create leaders, we don't just create followers, where we create an environment where our future generations will step up and take that leadership mantle. Thank you very much.